This voice has always guarded me well, and I have always understood it. It instructed me to be good and to go often to church. It told me it was necessary for me to come into France. You ask me under what form this voice appeared to me? You will hear no more of it from me this time. It said to me 2 or 3 times a week, you must go into France. My father knew nothing of my going. The voice said to me, go into France. I could stay no longer. It said to me, go, raise the siege which is being made before the city of Orléans. Go, it added, to Robert de Baudricourt, captain of Vaucouleurs. He will furnish you with an escort to accompany you. Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron.
Go into France.
Or as they call him in France, Aran.
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 France. Tapa.
Oui.
C'est toi. So, what I just read for you was another excerpt from the trial of Joan of Arc. A character who we've been trailing for quite some time and will be introducing at long last today.
Yes, yes, yes. And she is one of the most, I would say, singular characters in the entire Middle Ages. Like, there are people who share traits with her, and she is part of a tradition in some respects. But she is also an utterly transformative, some might say suicidally brave person who really does manage to sort of grab the helm of history for a shining brief moment and make her impact. So where we left you, I feel like we should have something at the start that says previously on Weird But Evil Guys.
And then we just play like a montage of quotes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Previously on Weird But Evil Guys, England and France are at total war and have been for almost a century. France is bitterly divided between two factions, the Armagnacs, who are the supporters of the Dauphin, the Crown Prince of France. The Burgundians are the supporters of the Dukes of Burgundy, who were another sort of branch of the French royal line, who rode in to support the claim of King Henry V of England to the French throne. Now, at the point at which we finished the last episode, Henry V's son, Henry VI, has been recognized as King of France. The Armagnacs are on the ropes. One of their key strongholds, the city of Orléans, is being besieged by a combined English and Burgundian army, and it seems like the entire edifice is about to come crashing down. But let's leave Orléans for a second and go to the other side of France and talk about a little girl hanging out and spinning wool.
Yes, so you may be familiar with Joan of Arc from the classic 90s kids TV show on PBS, Wishbone, which of course featured her in their episode Bone of Arc.
Just which kidding. Olivia pulled a gun on me and forced me to watch 5 minutes ago.
That's right. Unlike Aaron, who never subjects me to any media against my will. So anyways, there's this... The principle is that he's a Jack Russell Terrier.
Oh, God.
okay, sorry.
No, you started so you'll finish.
Needed to get that one out of my system.
No, you started so
you'll
finish.
Should I do a live reading of the whole meme that's like, okay, you know what? Be careful what you wish for,
oh,
Aaron.
God.
Someone wrote like a 5-page meme about Wishbone that's like pitched as a theoretical dialogue between a theoretical pitch meeting for Wishbone. I wouldn't have read it out loud, but you said you wanted to hear it, so. Visionary. So there's this dog. PBS suits. We're listening. Visionary. And he loves books. PBS suit. Like a cartoon dog? No. A live Jack Russell Terrier. He belongs to a boy named Joe. Nice.
You're just making problems for yourself.
And Joe reads him the books? No, Joe couldn't care less about books. Joe and his friends' day-to-day scrapes resemble the plot lines of great novels, and Wishbone, like, picks up on it. Wishbone? The dog. Should we name him something literary? Something like Dogstoya? No, his name is Wishbone. Unlike his human companion, Wishbone is a great lover of books. When Joe's life reminds him of a masterpiece, as it so often does, our canine Virgil guides the audience on a journey into that book. So the dog can talk? Nope, Joe and his friends and Joe's mom just think he's a regular dog. Rather than introduce Joan, or as she would more properly be known in France, Jean, let's let her introduce herself. Here's a quote from her. In my own country, they call me Jeannette. Since I came into France, I have been called Jean. Of my surname, I know nothing. I was born in the village of Domrémy, which is really one with the village of Greux. The principal church is at Greux. My father is called Jacques d'Arc. My mother, Isabelle. I was baptized in the village of Domrémy. I was, I believe, baptized by Monsieur Jean Minet. He still lives, so far as I know. I am, I should say, about 19 years of age. From my mother, I learned my pater, my Ave Maria, and my credo. I believe I learned all this from my mother.
So Jeannette d'Arc is, I would say, a very, very normal girl in the early 15th century. Her parents, like we heard, are Jacques and Isabelle, and they're a small holding farming family in Domrémy. Now, her father was a sort of village bigwig, important guy. Her mother was hugely religious. She actually went on pilgrimage to Rome at one point earlier in her life, which tells us that, you know, although they were relatively ordinary people, they had the time and money to do that, which suggests they were, for peasants, relatively well off. And her mother, by the way, was an absolutely huge influence on her. She taught her, she raised her as a very strict, observant Catholic, and taught her how to spin wool, make her useful around the village.
Well, this was something that absolutely everyone knew how to do in the Middle Ages, every woman. So she was given a normal education.
But never taught to read or write. Because, which, again, is completely normal. Wouldn't have needed to. Christine de Pizan, she is not. So her mother would also later say that when she was young, Jeannette was hugely empathetic. We have a quote from her where she says that, because the people suffered so much, she had a great compassion for them in her heart. And despite her youth, she would fast and pray for them with great devotion and fervor. I should also say that she had three brothers and a sister.
Domrémy, I think then and now, is not, apart from being the birthplace of this remarkable person we're discussing, a particularly significant place. It's a small village. It was very agricultural in the Middle Ages, as most of these places were. And as we heard from Joan, there was a church nearby.
It's not even big enough to have its own church.
Yeah.
Which is, in and of itself, a think telling.
Most places had their own church in the Middle Ages. So we don't hear that much from Joan about her early life, especially her early childhood. That we know from her trial that she grew up with three siblings, and that she would spend time with the other children in the village. She even recounts a few instances when she would go with some of the other village girls to a large beech tree in Domrémy that was said by the villagers to be extremely old and extremely large, and where the girls would sit and create flower garlands and sing and sometimes dance. And the exact nature of this tree and the relationship the villagers had with it, including Joan, is slightly contested. And we'll get into this a little bit more. But according to Joan, the villagers of Domrémy treated this tree as if it were a magic tree. As if there were fairies living in it. As if the flower garlands that they would make and hang in the branches might be offerings to those fairies. And the tree wasn't the only thing in the area that was alleged to have magical capabilities. There was also apparently a spring where people who wished to be healed would go and drink the water. And we should say this isn't really particular to Domremy, no. Is it?
No, I mean, the idea of having, like, the idea that there are localized supernatural entities and powers that are not necessarily sort of, you know, angels or mythological creatures that are lifted directly from the Bible, right? The idea that there is just magic in the world is not a particularly notable one, even by the 15th century. Like, this is an era of magic. Magic is real. At this point in time. Like,
fairies are real.
And there's...
elves are real.
There are so many magic trees.
Yes.
This is completely by the by. But of course, this is the sort of folk belief that is looked upon quite poorly by the central ecclesiastical authorities. Like, ever since this is the sort of thing that Pope Gregory the VII absolutely hated.
Yeah.
Like, every time there's an attempt at church reform, they're like, and can you please do something about all these goddamn magic trees? can you get these people to understand that there's one kind of magic, and it's Jeebus.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it would be like if you moved from, I don't know, somewhere really remote in England to London, and you were like, oh yeah, we used to love doing the Wicker Man Festival in my village where we would all burn an effigy. And everyone would be like, oh, we burn effigies here, but in a different, less sinister way. So, like, that's actually quite bad that you do that.
Only if local politicians we disapprove of.
Exactly.
But a very important thing to say at this point is that just because there's a magic tree does not mean that the villagers are in some kind of Wicker Man pagan cult.
Yes, I think that's an important thing to establish, because actually conceptions of folk magic and Christianity coexisted very nicely in the Middle Ages. And every time someone says that Christmas is around, that Christmas and Easter are when they are because the church wanted to stamp out pagan holidays, a pagan angel loses its wings.
We have an episode about exactly this.
Yes.
Now, Domremy is a predominantly Armagnac village in terms of their political sympathies, but they are and they are surrounded by, for the most part, Burgundian territory. But Domremy is largely untouched by the war, actually, unusually, for most of the time that Joan is alive. This lasts until 1425, when Joan is about 13. And the village is raided by Burgundians.
Yeah, and the way it's described, it sounds absolutely horrifying, because they flee, and when they come back, the whole village has been torched, and everything is gone. Their livestock is either gone or has been killed. Their houses have been burnt. Some of them haven't fallen down because they're stone, but they're basically skeletons or shells. It's completely destroyed.
The events of that raid have a very, very, very profound impact on her, because that is when she experiences her first vision. How long is it since you've had food and drink?
Since yesterday afternoon.
How long is it since you heard your voices?
I heard them yesterday and today.
At what hour yesterday did you hear them?
Yesterday, I heard them three times. Once in the morning, once at Vespers, and then again when the Ave Maria rang in the evening. I have even heard them oftener than that.
What were you doing yesterday morning when the voice came to you?
I was asleep. The voice awoke me.
Was it by touching your arm?
It awoke me without touching me.
Was it in your room?
Not so far as I know, but in the castle.
Did you thank it? And did you go on your knees?
I did thank it. I was sitting on the bed. I joined my hands. I implored its help. The voice said to me, "Answer boldly." I asked advice as to how I should answer, begging it to entreat for this the counsel of the Lord. The voice said to me, "Answer boldly. God will help thee." Before I had prayed to it to give me counsel, it had said to me several words I could not readily understand. After I was awake, it said to me, "Answer boldly. You say you are my judge. Take care in what you are doing. For in truth, I am sent by God, and you place yourself in great danger." Very shortly after this Burgundian raid that happens on Domrémy, Joan has her first vision. This is what we're told from her trial transcripts. It came towards noon on a summer's day in her father's garden, when she was not fasting and had not fasted on the previous day. She heard the voice on her right towards the church, and she seldom heard it without a light. The light came from the same side as the voice, and generally there was a great light. This is the first of many, many episodes that Joan has throughout her life where she hears and sees things that she interprets as being the presence of saints and angels.
Things that other people do not see and experience.
Exactly. And so on this first occasion, it takes the form of three saints: Saint Michael, Saint Catherine, and Saint Margaret, who visit her surrounded by angels. And she says that the first time this happened, she was very frightened, but very soon she realized that these were saints and angels.
These visions and these voices, she would have these experiences often daily, sometimes multiple times a day. It was especially common for her if she heard the sound of church bells ringing, and when they didn't ring and she didn't have these experiences, she would miss them, and she would go and beg the church warden in the village to go and ring the bells so that she could have this kind of transcendent experience. Her neighbors often said that when she was in the field and heard bells, she would drop to her knees, and they assumed that she was saying her prayers, but Joan was in fact listening for voices. She was dependent on them in some ways.
Yeah, there's, I think, a really illuminating, really sad moment from her trial where she says of the first time that she saw this presence. She says, "I saw them with my bodily eyes as well as I see you. And when they left me, I wept, and I fain would have had them take me with them too." So she's crying because she wants to go with them. She doesn't want to be left on Earth.
So Joan doesn't tell anybody about the visions or the voices for the first 4 years. She doesn't tell priests or friends or even her parents. So it almost feels offensive to ask the question, but I think people are going to, so we should address at the very least the question, what's going on here? Because I think that's a valid thing for somebody listening to this in the modern day to ask.
Yeah, and it's something that is asked frequently. So the explanation that's given the most frequently is psychosis or schizophrenia. Trying to diagnose someone with this who died 600 years ago is incredibly problematic from a, you know, historical point of view.
It's inappropriate from a medical point of view.
Yes, absolutely.
I think it's an activity trying to diagnose Joan of Arc with some form of neurodivergence or some form of mental disorder is worse than unhelpful. I think you know, like you say, you can't ask her. And B, even if you could, our entire understandings of, like, what is a neurotypical brain, what is normal behavior, are socially constituted based on social norms that we have sort of all, we've all sort of bought into whether we like it or not, right? So even if you could do what, take one of these, like, do I have autism online tests and did it on Joan of Arc, you would get nonsense results. So from a medical point of view, I don't think it's worth asking the question. But from a more, from a historical point of view, I think it's missing the forest for the trees in a pretty humongous way, in that there's nobody in this story that we are telling who is going to, who hears about her experiences and talks to her and goes, yeah, this girl is crazy.
No, I think there's no one who's saying, oh, she's making it up.
Yeah. It is completely expected in medieval life. There are going to be some people who have otherworldly experiences, supernatural experiences, encounters with the, with things beyond this world. The only question is, are those things here to help you? The question is very rarely, is this person mentally unwell? The question is more likely to be, who are they seeing and who are they speaking to, and are they divine or infernal?
Yeah. I think coming at it from a slightly modern perspective, God forgive me, I think one thing that I would say going ahead, and I won't try to diagnose or categorize, but it's the fact that she's, you know, a young girl who grew up in a time of war. And, you know, insofar as this word can be used, trauma, is that related to the fact that she's having these experiences?
And is the fact that there is a general upsurge in female mysticism after the Black Death and the intensification of the Hundred Years' War, is that connected perhaps as well? Who can say? Yeah, I mean, I think for my part, I think I approach this story from the perspective of, it doesn't matter what the chemicals were in her brain that made her see the things that she saw, because she saw them and she made decisions based on them, and people around her made decisions based on those decisions that would change the course of history forever.
So let's get into that.
Yes. Her voices are telling her from very early on, you need to go to France. Which, by the way, when she says go to France, she means go to the center of the kingdom. As we talked about at the start of this series, 100 fucking episodes ago, what is France and what is the domains that sort of are held by the feudal vassals of the French king can be a bit blurry at times. And so that's a bit of terminology that it's important to note. Anyway, so the voices are telling her, you need to go to France. You need to save the kingdom, basically. The voices are telling her that she needs to go to France and she needs to help the Dauphin reclaim the kingdom. And they're telling her to go to Robert de Baudricourt, who is the local sort of captain of the militia, and get him to take her to the Dauphin. Now, her, by the way, I should say, her parents are completely against this, because they're like, yeah, I'm going to let my teenage daughter go and hang out with a strange man and then go to war. Cool. I love this. Now, in May 1428, she convinces her uncle to take her to Robert de Baudricourt, to ask him to give her an armed escort to the Armagnac court in Chinon. And he actually does take her, and she meets Robert, and he basically says, what? No? What are you talking about? Basically just dismisses her very, very bluntly. But in July, Domremy is raided again, and she goes again to Robert, and she is refused again. Although while she's there, word does spread that there's this sort of mysterious girl showing up with visions from God. And the Duke of Lorraine, who is seriously ill at the time, does invite her to meet with him, basically on the off chance that she has like a magical cure that can cure him of his illness. Now, she meets him, and she does not offer him any cures, but she does tell him off for living with his mistress. She's so cool. She can be very severe at times when it comes to, like, moral things, which I find quite endearing about her. So she tried one last time with Robert in February 1429. And this time she came to him with a very specific warning. She said that she had had a terrible vision of the Dauphin's armies defeated near Orléans. And he's like, go away. Please leave me alone. But on that very day, possibly at that very moment, the Scottish Earl of Darnley is leading basically what's left of the Scottish army plus some Armagnac troops in a desperate attempt to break the siege of Orléans, and they are slaughtered almost to a man. And so when the news reaches Robert a few days later, you can imagine that he turned quite deathly white and was like, the captain will see you now. So, you know, suddenly she's actually had a prophecy come true. And so he takes her much more seriously now. And so he summons her and agrees to sponsor her to visit the Dauphin. And he gives her a bodyguard of a few soldiers. I think it's 6 soldiers. And this little, like, fellowship of people sets off on a journey to Chinon, which is on the other side of the country. And France is a very big country. Now, while she's on that journey, to keep herself safe from sexual assault, because she is a young girl who's traveling through very, very dangerous country of a country that's at war, she only wears men's clothes to blend in.
Yeah, so she wears men's clothing, men's armor, and she does so for the rest of her life, for the most part, unless forced to wear women's clothing. So she must have cut, I think, a very striking figure. This, you know, we don't know that much about what she looked like, but we know she was quite diminutive. I think around 5'2" is what I've read. And she also cuts her hair, which we know is, we know that she's dark haired. She cuts it into what can only be described as a bowl cut.
It was the style at the time.
Yeah, because that was the male haircut at the time.
Was it God who prescribed you the dress of a man?
What concerns this dress is a small thing. Less than nothing. I did not take it by the advice of any man in the world. I did not take this dress or do anything but by the command of our Lord and of the angels.
Did it appear to you that this command to take man's dress was lawful?
All I have done is by our Lord's command. If I had been told to take some other, I should have done it, because it would have been his command.
Did you not take this garment by order of Robert de Baudricourt?
No.
Did you think it was well to take a man's dress?
All that I have done by the order of our Lord, I think, has been well done. I look for good surety and good help in it.
In this particular case, this taking of a man's dress, do you think you did well?
I have done nothing in the world but by the order of God.
When you had come into France, did you wish to be a man?
I have answered this elsewhere.
Would you like to have a women's dress?
Give me one, and I will take it and be gone. Otherwise, no. I am content with what I have, since it pleases God that I wear it.
So this is interesting, isn't it? Okay, I'm going to ask once again. What's going on here?
This, I think, is even more inscrutable than trying to interrogate her mental health. Not that that's kept people from trying to scrutinize it, because she's had lots of labels applied to her. People have said, oh, she was a trans man, or she was non-binary.
Well, these are questions that are being asked of her at the time, which I find absolutely fascinating. They're basically, like, in the trial, they're basically going, gender dysphoria, yes or no?
Yeah.
That's not what they call it, but you know what I mean.
No, I think it's exactly true. And I think part of this is that there are legitimate reasons in the Middle Ages, even, for a woman to wear a man's clothing. This has, you know, been decided by the church, and that those reasons might be, if there's nothing else available, it would surely be better for a woman to wear a man's clothes than to go naked. But also, if a woman is trying to disguise herself for her own safety, i.e. to protect her own purity, then that could also be a legitimate reason. And so, yeah, what they're really trying to interrogate here is whether she's wearing these clothes because she wants to, or because she has to. And her opinion is clearly that because God has told her to wear this clothing, that she has to. And perhaps the person who's asking her these questions is of the opinion that it's not God, and that there is a more perceivedly sinister reason for it. But as far as we know, Joan believed that God had told her to dress in a man's clothing, and that was the only reason she ever gave for doing that.
Yeah, we really have no actual evidence that she ever identified as anything other than a woman. Because, and I feel quite confident in that assessment, because we have so much, we have such rich firsthand testimony of her that, and she was so utterly unafraid of answering boldly that I feel like it would have come up.
Yes.
Like, you know, she's in the trial threatening the judge.
Yeah. I think there was clearly made people uncomfortable seeing her dressed in such a way, especially with her hair cut short. I mean, I think even today, there's something about it that doesn't feel right to people, because if you look at any depiction of Joan of Arc from the past, you know, since she died, or even those made during her own lifetime, because there are one or two of those, she usually has long hair. Yes. Maybe she's wearing a breastplate, but she's
boob
got
armor.
Some kind of,
yeah, she has boob armor.
She's got a long skirt, maybe, and this isn't stuff that we would have seen on her during her life. That's well attested.
She looked like a boy. Before she left Robert's camp, she told her first admirers that
no one else in the world can recover the kingdom of France. There is no succor to be expected save from me, because my lord wills that I should do it.
So, Jeanne arrives in Chinon in March 1429, and she meets with the Dauphin, where she tells him what we just heard, that she is on a divine mission to liberate Orléans and to lead him to Reims, which is the historic crowning place of French kings, which is currently in the hands of the Burgundians. She will lead him to Reims for his coronation. Now, they have a private exchange.
No, and nobody overhears what exactly it is that she says to the king. But she does recount the exchange during her trial. I went without hindrance to the king. Having arrived at the village of St. Catherine de Fierbois, I sent for the first time to the castle of Chinon, where the king was. I got there toward midday and lodged first at an inn. After dinner, I went to the king, who was at the castle. When I entered the room where he was, I recognized him, among many others, by the counsel of my voice, which revealed him to me. I told him that I wished to go and make war on the English.
When the voice showed you the king, was there any light?
Pass on.
Did you see an angel over the king?
Spare me. Pass on. Before the king set me to work, he had many apparitions and beautiful revelations.
What revelations and apparitions had the king?
I will not tell you. It is not time to answer you about them. But send to the king, and he will tell you.
What we do know is that the Dauphin, Charles, sent Joan to be tested by the greatest spiritual authority that was currently available to the slight, at this point, quite ramshackle Armagnac court, which is who is Jean Garçon, who was an elderly, retired academic who had worked at the University of Paris before the Burgundians took over, when he basically had to flee in 1418. Now, Garçon was most famous for writing a treatise called On the Proving of Spirits, which is a treatise on distinguishing true and false visions. And he was also famous for being a cantankerous old crank. So, nevertheless, Jean Garçon interrogated Joan, and he ultimately concluded that she was probably sincere.
Do you know what else Garçon is known for?
I think I know what you're going to say, but say it.
Being friends with Christine de Pizan.
Wait, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh. How's she doing? What's up with her?
Well, he was during...
Sorry, the... I feel like I've bumped into a mutual friend.
Yes.
Oh, it feels so good to see you again.
When they were having the debate over the romance of the rose, she was on the same side as Jean de Garçon.
You know what? God bless Jean de Garçon. I have a lot of affection for him.
Yeah, they were buddies. They were tag teaming the other guys.
I really like the idea of Christine de Pizan just having a mate who's just like a cranky old academic.
Yeah, and I think and the fact that all of these famous people, not just the king, but all of these academics as well, are kind of converging to see what's up with Joan, I think probably tells us that word is getting out.
Yes.
I think that probably people are starting to talk about this.
Well, because I sort of suspect, putting two and two together, that I don't think Joan is particularly subtle. She's not moving really with any sort of like, she's not hiding her intentions. You know, she got to think back to Valacour when she was just hanging out for a couple of days with Robert de Baudricourt, and the Duke of Lorraine found out about her. Like, she's not in hiding. She's like, what up, everybody? I'm going to save France, and I talk to God.
Yep.
So, with Garçon pretty much satisfied, the royal court are satisfied that they're willing enough to take a punt, basically, because, again, they are really out of options. Their big push a couple of years ago when the Scottish army arrived has basically disintegrated. They're kind of hanging on by their fingernails a little bit. And so, yeah, sure, why not bring a sort of a magical teenager along as a talisman?
So one thing that happens while she's in Chinon with the Dauphin is that he commissions a suit of custom plate armor for her. Probably because it's hard to find armor made for 5'2", 17-year-old girls. And she also designs her own custom standard, which she bears into battle. And this is made for her. And she has a sword given to her as well, so she really looks the part of a warrior. And interestingly enough, it's also around this time that she starts going by the epithet La Pucelle.
The maid, judging that she probably couldn't make things any worse. The Dauphin sent Joan to Blois to join the head of a relief convoy of food for Orléans, accompanied by 100 men-at-arms and 400 Scottish archers. From Blois, Joan dictated a message to the English besieging forces.
King of England and you, Duke of Bedford, who call yourself regent of the Kingdom of France, you, William de la Poole, Earl of Suffolk, John, Lord of Talbot, and you, Thomas, Lord Scales, who do call yourselves Bedford's lieutenants, do right by the King of Heaven. Hand over to the maiden, who is sent here by God, the King of Heaven, the keys to all the towns which you have taken and violated in France. She has come here in the name of God to support the royal family. She is quite prepared to make peace, if you are willing to do right, as long as you give up France and make amends for occupying it. And you, archers, soldiers both noble and otherwise, who around the town of Orléans, in God's name, go back to your own lands. And if you will not do so, await word of the maiden, who will go to see you very soon to your great misfortune. King of England, if you do not do so, I am a commander, and whenever I come across your troops in France, I shall make them go, whether willingly or unwillingly. And if they will not obey, I will have them wiped out. If you do not believe the tidings sent by God and the maiden, wherever we find you, we will strike against you, and will cause such a great clash of arms there that not for 1,000 years has France seen one as great, if you do not do right.
It's pretty cool. Uh-huh. It goes on. The thing that I find so interesting about this letter is that it then goes on for another, like, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It's very rambling. It's not very coherent. It's not following traditional sort of, writing structures or anything. It's very obviously something that she very literally dictated to somebody, just basically ranting on, listing off a list of threats for all the terrible things she's going to do to the English, which makes it infinitely cooler than basically any other letter we get to read on this show.
Absolutely. There's a lot of conviction written in there, I think.
This is a 17-year-old girl who's saying, to the King of England, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
So, it's worth saying at this point a little bit about how the Siege of Orléans, which has been happening at this point for months and months and months and months, is operating. Basically,
shouldn't Orléans have, like, I don't know, a guy who's in charge, who's, you know, maybe a royal, a noble, but no, he's in London trying to figure out, you know, whether he should rhyme deer with fear or here.
Meanwhile, his half-brother, Louis the Bastard of Orléans, is running the show with able assistance from La Hire. La Hire is a very interesting character. I believe he comes from a very sort of, not lowly, but sort of relatively normal background. And he was a veteran at the Battle of Baugé, that great Scottish victory that reinvigorated the Armagnac cause for a couple of years there. And he seems to have risen through the ranks through genuinely on merit. What I love about him is there are two theories as to why he gets his nickname. Is the name La Hire is not his actual name. It's a nickname that means the wrath. There are two theories. One is because it's that the English called him Deus Ire, or the wrath of God. The other is that he got it because people called him Le Hirisson, which is French for hedgehog.
Aww.
On account of his prickly personality.
That's sweet.
So he's this sort of like, he seems this very gruff kind of, this very gruff military guy.
Wow, this reminds me of this anime.
Oh god.
What, you're allowed to this reference is like, media, but I'm not?
This is the media. I think that Aaron's a big dickhead because he has interests.
No, I'm just saying I should get to talk about anime.
Fine, you have 30 seconds.
So in Naruto, just kidding. Let's carry on.
So let's set the scene a little bit about how the siege is actually operating in practice. Orléans sits on the River Loire. It's on the north bank of the river. It's connected to the south bank by a bridge that goes over an island in the middle of the river, and over to the other side. At the front of that bridge is a castle called La Tourelle, which is being controlled at this point by the English. The English have also built a series of fortifications around the city that are a bastard to try and get past. But if you have a large enough relief colony and you go in at exactly the right point, you can probably get past the English fortifications. If, again, safety in numbers, if you're very, very, very careful. And this is the plan to relieve Orléans. So on April 29th, Joan and the convoy arrive at Orléans within basically what has turned into a bit of a religious procession. People are waving banners and chanting and so on. And because of the size of the convoy, the English don't try and attack it as it's coming through. So she's able to enter the city. Now, legend says that as she enters the city, the bagpipers in the Scottish archers division strike up an old marching song that was played by Robert Bruce's army before the Battle of Bannockburn.
Thank you.
when Jeanne gets in, she is heralded already as a hero, because there's this, again, word has gotten around that there is this this magical girl who is going to save France. The English, meanwhile, are calling her a witch and a whore, as you can imagine. Very, very mature of them. And she meets the bastard of Orléans and La Hire, and they react in a mixed way. I would say that most of the defenders do not really take to her, because they are sort of hardy military men, and she's a 17-year-old girl. Although we do know that La Hire was completely taken with her pretty much immediately, and they become like besties instantly, which I find very charming.
Oh yeah,
it's very much like in Furiosa. Furiosa hitting it off with Praetorian Jack.
Yeah, it's like how in Naruto and Sasuke still manage to be friends by the end.
Those aren't real names.
Oh, sorry. It's like how in Dragon Ball. I've never seen Dragon Ball.
You're a fake anime fan.
Thank you.
Jeanne meets with the commanders, and she's like, "Okay, let's do it. We're here. Let's do it. I'm here, and I'm gonna free France. So let's attack." And the bastard of Orléans is like, no, we don't have enough men for that. So he goes off to summon more reinforcements, who arrive on the 4th of May. Now, while that's happening, over the intervening 4 days, Jeanne is touring the city, distributing charity to the poor, talking to people. So on the 4th of May, the bastard of Orléans organizes an attack on the easternmost English fortification with the troops that he's brought. Now, Jeanne missed out on most of it because she was having a nap while this happened, and she was not being clued into the... She was not at this stage being clued into the strategy conversations.
They were probably waiting for her to have a nap so they could do something. No, literally. Like...
After a couple of hours, the bastion falls, and holy shit. We've taken out one of the fortifications. More supplies can come in. We're back, baby. It was so over, but now we're so back. So the next day, Jeanne was like, "Okay, brilliant. We've taken one of them. Let's go. 5th of May, Ascension Day. It's perfect. Let's just go and murder everybody." And again, the French commanders go, "We actually need to rest our trip. I love your energy." "I love your enthusiasm, but that's insane." And so Jeanne goes off to do her own thing. At an overnight war council, it's decided that they're going to make an attack the next day on the 6th of May to clear the bastions on the south bank. Now, as the troops are assembling at first light, there's this massive crowd of civilians who start showing up. And the commander's like, "What on earth is going on? What is this? What's happening right now?" And it turns out that Joan of Arc has been raising a militia from the civilians of the city. And it's drawn from every walk of life. You have laborers and merchants and butchers and everyone coming together, hundreds upon hundreds of people coming together to defend their city, inspired by the arrival of the Maid. And the bastard of Orléans goes, "This is not at all what we talked about." "What are you doing?" But eventually he's persuaded to let the militia join in the attack. Using boats and a makeshift pontoon bridge, La Hire is able to lead an operation to cross the river and attack the English on the south bank. Now, his troops cross the river and they start attacking the first of the English fortifications, and the English, unsurprisingly, start firing on the French. And the French soldiers start to flee. But legend says, Jeanne grabs her standard and waves it and screams, "En nom de Dieu!" Which means, "In the name of God." Which apparently inspired the French to weather the hail of arrows and charge the next fort and overrun it. It's a huge success, but in the battle, Jeanne is wounded in the foot by stepping on a metal spike. And so it seems like she's going to have to sit out the assault, the final assault on La Tourelle. And that evening, La Hire leads a nighttime raid to take the next fort again, leaving La Tourelle, the main sort of center of the English defenses, exposed and vulnerable. So the next day, Joan is being very heavily advised by everyone in Orléans, just like, you did a great job yesterday, honey. Just please sit this one out. You do not need to be involved. You've been wounded in the foot. You're going to have a terrible time. But she says, no, 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 no. I am an emissary of God. I will be there on the battlefield. Thank you very much. So on the 7th of May, the French army makes one final assault on La Tourelle. In the charge on the fortification, Joan actually gets hit in her shoulder with an arrow and collapses. And there's a huge cheer from the English, defenders, sort of, because, you know, we took out your magic teenager. Get fucked. But according to the eyewitnesses, she actually pulls the arrow out herself. And then as soon as she can stand up again, is back in the fray that evening for the final charge. And she is in the final taking of La Tourelle. She is there from the very beginning, like yelling at people, saying, get it together, we're gonna do this. And she tells the soldier that as soon as her banner touches the fortress wall, La Tourelle will be theirs. And then when they get to the wall and she touches her banner against the wall, the French soldiers rush in cheering and swarm up ladders into the fortress, and it's taken. And mon Dieu, Orléans s'est libéré. In the wake of this is a victory that resonates throughout France, not just because it's a huge victory for the Armagnacs, who have been incredibly beleaguered this entire time, but also because of the nature of the victory and the involvement of this profoundly supernatural young woman. And it's almost like there's this kind of explosion of hope that there will finally be an end to this awful, terrible war that has been going on for generations and generations and generations. Jean Gerson, in the last weeks of his life, even though he is ailing and sick, he writes a treatise, sort of defending Joan against any criticisms that she may be, you know, the servant of the devil, that gets circulated all over France. And news of this miraculous young woman who has taken destiny into her own hands even reaches the remote nunnery that is now the home of
Christine de Pizan. And Christine de Pizan, who you'll be intimately familiar with if you've listened to much of the podcast already, especially our episode about medieval feminism, because she has been indeed referred to by some as the world's first feminist. She writes the last work of her life as well, just like her dear friend Jean Gerson. She dies very shortly after this. And she writes the story of Joan of Arc. Oh, what honor for the female sex! It is perfectly obvious that God has special regard for it, when all these wretched people, who destroyed the whole kingdom, now recovered and made safe by a woman, something that 5,000 men could not have done. And these traitors have been exterminated.
Well, the truth is, at this point, Joan's quest is only half done. You know, she has liberated Orléans like she said she would, but the Dauphin is still not crowned as king. A huge swathe of the country is still in the hands of the English or the Burgundians. Things are still bleak. Things are still pretty dire. But she is, at this moment, she is absolutely 100% convinced, I would say, that not only can she save France, but she will save France. But to find out how that goes, you're going to have to tune in next time.
That's right.
Well, that is just about going to do us for this episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. This was meant to be the ending of episode 2. It is now the ending of episode 3. We will see... If we can finish this story in one episode, I have my doubts.
We shall see. One beefy episode, mayhaps.
But I will say that if you think this episode has been full of drama and, like, outrageous characters and supernatural happenings, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's only going to get more intense. It's only going to get more dramatic. And it's only going to get much, much, much scarier.
So, Aaron, where can people find you on social media?
You can find me at Aaron P. Tappers on Twitter and at Aaron on Blue Sky.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter at Weird Medieval, or my personal is at Olivia_MS. And if you enjoy our podcast and you feel that it's deserving of a 5-star rating, then we would love it if you gave one to us on the listening platform of your choice. And you can even leave us a little message on Spotify in the "What did you think about this episode" box, and we might just read it out.
Yes. Yeah, I'd like to read out a comment from an episode that, from your perspective as listeners, was from months ago, but from our perspective was only a few weeks ago that we recorded it, which is Federica Pisacane. I'm sorry, I hope I got that right. My Italian is not what it used to be. It wasn't good before, and now it's gotten worse. Who commented on the football episode. Excellent episode as always, though I did not like the "Italian should be better at rugby" bit. We are trying our best. Also, I was surprised that somebody outside of Italy knew that Renzi's video. OMG. Well, I would say that I imagine that your first reaction was shock. Shock because... I love that video. It's very dear to my heart. And I will say thank you from the bottom of my heart for bringing up Italian rugby without having a go at me for the fact that Italy beat Scotland in the last Six Nations.
Yes, because you guys are doing your best.
You're doing pretty good at the moment.
You're on the up and up. So yeah. That was low-hanging fruit.
You're better than Wales.
Yeah.
All right. Don't worry, Wales. We still love you, Wales.
Peace and love.
You'll get them next time.
We'll see you in a free France.
Peace and love, Ringo. Okay. That's what he always says after every...